Go.
Vital.
We're go flight.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go flight.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the July 22nd, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, here we go again with another attempt to jam about 3 hours worth of discussion about our space program into one concise, informative, and I hope entertaining hour. We're so glad to have you join us on this Sunday afternoon. My guest today will be Paul Damfus, the Executive Director of the National Space Society, which I will tell you more about shortly, but suffice it to say, we will be talking about the full range of space-related topics today. Military space, space education, NASA, the pro-space community, space policy, space politics. It will all be fair game on today's program. Plus, we'll review some of the top space news of the week and remind you about what we can expect in terms of the next launch from the Space Coast. And if that weren't enough, how about if you join us today with your questions or comments about the space program by calling us at 321-768-1240 or sending us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, and now here's this week's broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. As many of you know, this past week, the space community lost one of its most respected leaders with the passing of retired Air Force Lieutenant General Forrest McCartney after a tragic but mercifully brief battle with cancer. It was General McCartney who led the Kennedy Space Center through the dark days following the Challenger disaster, serving as KSC director from 1987 to 1991, and in doing so cemented his place as one of the great giants in space history. Before coming to Florida's Space Coast, the general had spent just about his entire career working in the military space program, with experiences that ranged from working on the original spy satellite program called Corona, to overseeing the construction of the never-used shuttle launch pad at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, a fact that I know gnawed at the general. "We were that close to launching when Challenger happened," he told me on more than one occasion. To say that the thousands of people who knew him and called him friend were shocked and saddened by the news of his sudden death would be an understatement. Devastated would perhaps be a better sentiment. Just as quickly as the well wishes and condolences poured in, inevitably the stories followed right behind, because it seems that, well, everyone who either met or worked with General McCartney had a story to tell. Such was the commanding, charismatic, and caring person he was. In announcing his passing to the KSC workforce, our current Senate Director, Bob Cabana, told of the time when the Space Shuttle launch team had gathered for a flight readiness review, which is the big management meeting held before every launch to look over everything and make sure everyone is ready to fly. Discovery was on the pad and go fever was percolating when there came a report that the external tank doors on the orbiter's belly may not have been rigged properly. Of course, the concern being they wouldn't be able to close tight when the shuttle had reached orbit, and if that were to happen, the crew wouldn't be able to safely return to Earth. Now, there was some discussion about the report and some reluctance expressed about the delay that would result if they had to roll the shuttle back to the Vehicle Assembly Building for repairs. When the launch readiness poll was being taken and it got to General McCartney, he said, "You can vote all you want, but Discovery's rolling back to the VAB to be checked out." Well, it turned out the doors were, in fact, rigged incorrectly, and McCartney very well may have saved the mission and the lives of the crew. Well, I have my own stories to tell about the general. I remember the first time I interviewed him in the privacy of his office on the fourth floor of the KSC headquarters building. We were talking about a particularly persistent problem the shuttle team was having with hydrogen leaks during the summer of 1990, and I asked him something about schedule pressure. He looked at me and said, "Turn the tape recorder off." I did, and then he lit into me with the barrage of language, well, that I can't repeat here, but it was intimidating enough, powerful enough, and even profound enough that it shook me to my core, taught me some important lessons about launch processing, and certainly encouraged me to do a better job of understanding what I was writing about so that I could ask smarter questions. You know, it's probably not even worth the footnote in the space history books, but I was the last journalist to officially interview the general when he was KSC director. It was his last day on the job. We were back up in his office, and instead of the tense business-like environment we had during that first interview there, this time around it was warm and friendly and even a little bit sad. The two things I remember most about that day were that I had him sign a return to flight poster for me, which I still proudly have hung on my living room wall. And the other is that all his office stuff had been packed up and only the bare furniture was left, with the exception of a small cardboard tray on his desk that was stamped KSC Recycles. Now, these little trays were on desks all over the Space Center, and we had our share of them at the press site, too. Anyway, one still sat on General McCartney's desk, and I thought it was poignant that inside the recycle tray sat a bunch of NASA business cards he had put there that said, "Forrest McCartney, Center Director." I told the general that story for the first time just this past April, and he smiled at the memory with that big grin of his. He remembered the interview, but not that bit about the recycle box. It was the last time I spoke with him, although, of course, I didn't know it at the time. That final opportunity came when we had all gathered for the annual National Space Club Florida Committee Debus Award Dinner, and I was serving as the MC. I was in the main dining room before the event started, where it was quiet. I was reviewing my notes while a couple hundred people were outside having a reception in a room nearby. Then out of the blue, in walks the general and his wife, Miss Ruth. You know, even the general called his wife Miss Ruth. They were looking to get away from the crowd for some peace and quiet as well, and for about 20 minutes, the two of them, with me and my wife Dawn, told stories about the good old days and laughed as we reminisced. I reminded him that I was still hoping he would write a book about his career and get down on paper all the stories about the people and experiences he had so that future generations could learn by his example. I also reminded him I had yet been able to convince him to be a guest on this Space Talk radio program. He said he was reluctant to do any of those things because he basically didn't want to overstay his welcome. He had seen some leaders that he admired do that and watched as they went from respected contributors to doddering old fools. Well, I told him that I wouldn't let him know, or that I would let him know when he had reached that age and become an old fool. We laughed, and he said he would think about it. And then he warned me that he and Miss Ruth might have to leave early so that he wouldn't be too tired for the drive home. Later on in the evening, during our break for dessert, he and Miss Ruth slipped out through the doors next to where I was sitting. He reached out to shake my hand. We said goodbye, and he was gone. The greatest and unexpected blessing I have had in my career associated with the space program is to be able to work and become friends with some remarkable people. A very few stand out in particular. And I can honestly say that with the exception of my own father, I have never known a man I admired, respected, and learned more from than Forrest McCartney, a genuine American hero. In what is classic General McCartney, he requested that no fuss be made about him, that no memorial service be held. So allow me to take this opportunity to publicly offer my condolences and love to Miss Ruth, daughters Maggie and Worthy, and the rest of the McCartney family. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. We're going to take our first break here. When we return, we'll be joined by Paul Damfus of the National Space Society. Don't forget the phone lines are open for your questions or comments. Maybe even if you have a story to share about General McCartney, I'd love to hear it too. Give us a call, 321-768-1240, or send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Now stay tuned. I'm Jim Behnke, and you are listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everybody. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to participate in the program today. You can also send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, as we begin this segment of the program, I do want to set the stage for today's guest and give you a quick brief history lesson. Following the conclusion of the Apollo program back in about 1972, original German rocket pioneer Wernher von Braun was looking at the national situation, concerned about future public support for our space program. And so about 1975, he started an organization called the National Space Institute to carry the torch of our space program. Almost at the same time, another organization called the L5 Society began in 1975. Now, the L5 named for what's called a Lagrange point, which is a point in orbit between any two big bodies in space that gravity kind of cancels each other out in a way. It's a stable place to put, for example, a giant space colony. And there was a scientist, a man named Gerard O'Neill, who thought it'd be pretty good to put a colony there at L5. And so the decision was made to form this organization to work toward that goal, and the ultimate goal being that when this space colony would finally be established at L5, the L5 Society would gather together inside this colony and officially disband the organization as considered mission success. So these two organizations are out there. From 1984 to 1987, I was involved at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach as a student leader of what we call there the L5 Aerospace Society. The two organizations merged along about 1986, 1987 to become the National Space Society, a pro-space group that has been doing good work all this time. Their first director, Lori Garver, now NASA's deputy administrator, and did quite a bit of work with her through the years and had to tell you quite a few stories about working with her. All good, by the way. So anyway, with that kind of background as to where it all came from, my guest today is Paul Damfus, the executive director of the National Space Society today. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Marines. Paul spent the final years of his career working military space and was named a Marine Corps astronaut candidate. We'll find out what that means. He also served as a space policy advisor for our own Senator Nelson, which now that I think about it may be the key to how he wound up at the Space Society. In any case, Paul Damfus joins us by phone from his office in our nation's capital. And, Paul, we welcome you aboard to Space Talk. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity. It's always great to speak with the folks down on the Space Coast.
Yeah, and I'm so glad to have the National Space Society represented here at a national level. Laura Seward, our local chapter person here, has been on the show and talking about great things they've been doing. But let's talk about the national organization. And first of all, let's tell the folks here a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? How do you hail? How did you wind up to where you're at today?
Yeah, well, that was a great setup regarding the National Space Institute and the L5 Society as to how they came about. And just one aside to that, as you pointed out, we did merge in 1987, which makes this year our 25th anniversary.
Oh, I hadn't counted that. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was precisely the proclamation was signed on the 28th of March, and it was really quite a privilege this year. On that very date, we presented the 2012 Robert A. Heinlein Memorial Award to Dr. Stephen Hawking. So on that very day, so that was really a great way to celebrate our 25th anniversary. I've been involved with the NSS since probably about 1999 or so when I joined as a member.
Yeah.
Had always thought of the NSS as sort of being head and shoulders, sort of the gold standard as far as space advocacy groups go, you know, really kind of a cut above all the other groups that are out there. And around the summer of 2009, right after George Whitesides had left to go on to become the chief of staff at NASA, the right. leadership at NSS had approached me about becoming the executive director and backfilling George. You know, it was actually several months after George had left, and we weren't able to come up with an agreement at that time. So I ended up staying active duty, and as you point out, spent just about 13 months working for Senator Nelson. So fast forward a couple years into 2011, we had another opportunity where the NSS approached me about coming on as the executive director. And having seen some of the things that have been going on here in D.C. and within the organization, I thought that it was a good time to jump on board and to address a lot of the challenges that that the organization had been facing over the last few years since George's departure.
And now, looking at your bio that you've got posted online, I'm trying to figure out the ages and stuff. We're not that far apart. You, it appears you, like me, grew up during the space program and followed the tracking of the Marines and helicopter flying.
Sure.
Has space been always been a part of about your fabric of your background?
Pretty much as far back as I can remember, it's always been space. So, you know, I was kind of blessed to know what I wanted to do with my life at a very early age. And
yeah.
My father was a Marine, and that also inspired me. And so I left, I started college, went down to the University of Arizona on a Navy ROTC scholarship, and then was commissioned as a second lieutenant, went to flight school, and spent the first half of my career as a pilot, doing several deployments overseas, places like Okinawa, Japan, did a couple of six-month deployments on the ship. But I never got space out of my system. It was always my goal to become an astronaut. Had the opportunity about midway through my career to attend the Naval Postgraduate School, and graduated from there with a master's in astronautical engineering, which then, you know, when you get a good deal like that in the military, there's always the payback on the back end.
Right,
so,
right.
Although in my case, it wasn't a hardship to where I went and spent 2 years at Colorado Springs at United States Space Command.
Yeah, lovely city.
Yeah, absolutely. So back to back, you know, between Monterey and Colorado Springs, it wasn't too bad of several years there.
Well, during let me ask you quick. During sure. your stay in the military, you know, and being a space conscious kind of a guy,
mm-hmm.
you know, looking at your tours of duty and stuff, you lived through this whole period of where space really became a major part of what folks on the ground were doing. I remember all sorts of stories during the original Persian Gulf War about GPS just starting to come online and troops literally buying their GPS units from the Sears catalog because
yep.
they couldn't get them fast enough through the military. And you've watched that whole transformation. I'm just curious to what your thoughts are about military space today and its importance not only to the warfighter but to the to our culture, our very way of life.
Sure. So during those 2 years that I was at Space Command, I was working some pretty highly classified stuff, really none of which are the details I can go into, but suffice it to say that we did all the planning leading up to Operation Iraqi Freedom, and one of my colleagues commented, you know, as hostilities started, he said, you know, we're in the midst of this geek war. We're doing our geek stuff, and they're doing their geek stuff, and we're responding in, you know, in geek fashion. I mean, it really was probably even more, obviously even more so than the Gulf War. The first war where space really did have a significant impact, some of it highly overt, and as you said, in GPS, in imagery, in real-time weather reporting,
sure,
but some
sure.
of it very, very covert as well.
Right, right. And all of that technology finding its way into our everyday lives. And as I look at things like, for example, Paul, the X-37B, the little mini space plane that's flown twice now, launched
that's
from
right.
here at the Cape,
yep.
landed Vandenberg Air Force Base, you wonder what else is out there in the military world, and I'm not necessarily asking you to discuss
right.
any details, but you wonder what's out there right now that can help us solve our problems on the civilian side moving forward.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's always you know, historical examples of how technology has come out of the black world and been declassified and found civilian uses. You know, so for the second half of my career, I ended up, after going to Space Command, I ended up going back to flying for a few years and did a couple of combat tours in Iraq, but then came back and worked in the Pentagon for 4 years. And one of the things, I was tasked with running advanced concepts, and one of the things that I really took a vested interest in pursuing was trying to link up the military with a lot of these new capabilities that we're seeing coming up. That are non-traditional players, and a lot of these folks that are operating suborbital vehicles and all. If you really think about it, it doesn't take much to really think about some of those vehicles, and about how the military can leverage those capabilities. And that was really one of the things that I pursued heavily. We have a very long-term vision in the Marine Corps, an actual codified need statement for a capability called SUSTAIN, which is an acronym for Small Unit Space Transport and Insertion Capability, and it eventually is a capability in the future where we use these suborbital and these high-speed point-to-point vehicles to be able to deliver Marines and boots on the ground at the scene of a crisis nearly instantaneously before that crisis is allowed to fully develop. So yeah. That's sort of the objective out there in the future. But certainly there's all kinds of other things that we can think of and that will come to be that there will be military applications for space.
That's great. Paul, stand by for a second. You know, I'm talking about all this military stuff. It's all about the message and why space is important. That gets right to the heart of what National Space Society is all about. We're going to explore that more here when we return in just a couple of minutes. We are going to stand by now. We take our five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour. Get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. And when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Paul Damfus of the National Space Society. Meanwhile, 321-768-1240, the number, spacetalking@AOL.com, the email. I'm Jim Behnke, and you are listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox are open for your questions or comments. The phone number 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@AOL.com. We're joined on the phone today from Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, is Paul Damfus, the executive director of the National Space Society. And, Paul, we're really glad to have you on board with us on a Sunday afternoon.
Oops. Think of a better topic to talk about than space.
Oh, it'll be great. Hey, you know, I wanted to take a moment and tell you a quick story about NSS down here in Florida. It's one of my favorite stories about how I was involved. And it's a Lori Garver story. It's real brief, but back when Apollo 13, the movie, was about to premiere, Lori, about 2 weeks before the official premiere national rollout, gives me a call, and I'm a reporter at Florida Today at the time, just a little newsroom reporter sitting there covering space, no big deal, right? Lori calls me up and says, how would you like to have one of our NSS education-type premieres of Apollo 13 at the Cape a couple days before it rolls out nationally? I says, this is a heck of a deal, a heck of an idea, Lori. Let me go talk to the publisher. And so, you know, one of the first times they ever, as a reporter, marched into the publisher's office, his name was Mike Coleman at the time, sat down in Mike's office and says, Mike, we have a chance to show Apollo 13 national premiere rollout before everybody else sees it here at the Cape. Are you interested? He doesn't say a word. He picks up the phone. He calls in the director of marketing. Ann comes in, sits down next to me. We tell her the idea. We've got 2 weeks to prepare a massive community event. And, you know, after she stopped swearing and fainting and all of that, said, let's go do it. And 2 weeks later, we had a giant premiere here, a big community reception. Fred Hayes, who at the time lived here at the Cape, Apollo 13 astronaut, was sort of the hero of the day. We had a nice reception at one of the hospitals. We went over to the Merritt Island on Merritt Island to watch the movie, filled two theaters. It was great. Fred Hayes was in the audience about a row behind me in the scene where Fred Hayes throws up. Everyone yells out, way to go, Fredo, all at the same time. And all of that was brought to you courtesy of the National Space Society and a phone call from Lori Garver. And I don't think anyone really ever knew where it came from or how it started, but that's how it happened. And it was a great event and a great example of how the Space Society gets the message out, uses the local chapters, and does what it does so well. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, that as a setup. What is the big picture of National Space Society? What is its role now? And again, how does it involve the chapters?
Sure. Well, as you pointed out, and of course, Lori is still a good friend to the NSS, and we're just beyond pleased to see her career move along, as well as George Whiteside's, who's spent 4 years in this role,
and a recent new father, I might add.
That's right. And the two of them have had just a huge impact on space going forward.
Yeah, and Paul, let me say real quick, sure. If anyone's familiar with Yuri's Night, that mm-hmm. all started with George and Loretta here in the United States. It had been happening over in Russia for some time, but
that's right. And Yuri's impact. Night still continues to go strong. We're actually partnering with Yuri's Night for the upcoming landing of the Mars Science Laboratory, Curiosity, on the 5th into the 6th of August.
In 2 weeks.
That's right. So, you know, we are still very true to our original roots, that going back to Von Braun and NSI and O'Neill and the L5 Society. But really, to capture it in a bumper sticker, our vision is really twofold, and that is the first half of it is seeing us becoming a spacefaring civilization, seeing right. thriving communities of folks living and working off the Earth. But the second half of it is utilizing the vast resources of space for the betterment of humanity, whether that be in situ resource utilization for future space missions or using those resources for the betterment of life here on Earth. We just saw the company Planetary Resources roll out their plan to mine asteroids, completely in line with what our vision is, as is things like space-based solar power. So that's really our vision, and it's a very long-term vision, and it's a very large vision. But bringing it down to the sort of the day-to-day and the here and now, we are a nonprofit 501c3 education grassroots organization, and with mm-hmm. that we are an education organization that enables us to go up onto the hill and to advocate for specific things. And the NSS has always had that very, very strong role of really being the adults in the room and really having the attention of the members and the staffs and the committee staffs, and working with NASA and working with the White House and working with other organizations. And, you know, it is a bottom-up. As I said, we are a grassroots organization. We're a member organization and a chapter organization. And so we really are the premier citizen's voice in space. It should come as no surprise. I mean, it's a very clear and present thing of all the changes that are happening, and especially that a lot of that is manifested down there on the Space Coast. We've been going through some very challenging changes. There is huge potential out there, but in the here and now, there really are a lot of challenges, and that's what we strive to work through. But we also strive to bring space out into the mainstream. One of the things that I've, since I've taken over the beginning of the year, is I find that we go and talk to other space advocacy groups, whether it be at a conference or some other venue. We tend to talk to one another. We tend to project our message sometimes to the already converted.
Sure.
It's what I call the echo chamber. And really, one of the things I've been pushing our folks to is let's step out of the echo chamber. Bring somebody who is not a space person to our conference. Bring them in as a member of the NSS. Let's get out into the mainstream. One of the best ways to reach the mainstream, as you pointed out, the Apollo 13 movie. We have a board of governors, many of whom are folks who are not necessarily space people, but are entertainers who have an interest in space. Tom Hanks is on our board of governors.
Sure,
Tom
sure.
Cruise, Hugh Downs, as well as John Glenn, Buzz Aldrin. So that's a great venue for reaching folks is through the entertainment industry, and we're working with those folks right now. As a matter of fact, I have a meeting in Los Angeles this Thursday on that very subject. So we're really trying to break out of that paradigm and really start bringing down to the Main Street individual the benefits of our varied space programs.
It's good to hear you talk about some of these kind of things, because the two things to worry about right now. First of all, I'm glad to hear that you're talking about some of the other things going on. There was a time, and I'm not sure it's true anymore, and part of that is historical, that the NSS was NASA's cheerleader, and so that anything NASA wanted, NASA to do, NSS knee-jerk response was to support it. Part of that was unfair, that description, because at that time NASA was really the only game in town. But as you start talking about all these commercial ventures, you talk about Planetary Resources, You talk about suborbital tourism, what George is working on over at Virgin Galactic right now, and all these other things going on, SpaceX and the Dragon. You've got a chance now to tell a space story that is much more comprehensive than just NASA and whatever NASA wants, NASA gets. And I think that's great. I think that needs to happen. But the other thing that I'm curious about, Paul, is when you're talking about talking to other space organizations, not only is there a problem with that you're talking to each other instead of to the outside, but it doesn't seem like the space folks can get along with the same message. You know, NASA or the Congress or the White House could roll out a credible opportunity to go do something, and then we all argue within ourselves about what we need to do. What rocket's best? Should it be the moon or Mars or the asteroids? And then all this conflict comes up, and we can't tell a coherent story together. What can NSS do, and what are you guys doing to address this idea that not only do we need to be talking to others, but we need to make sure we're all on the same page?
Right, and you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a variety of opinions out there. The NSS has the benefit of having a very broad umbrella where we really touch on all space issues, whereas some of the other groups are a little more specialized, have their niches that they and we sort of look at a much more synergistic viewpoint of the entire thing. And it's interesting when you talk about NASA is, we are not doing a service if we're going to just applaud everything that NASA does without challenging any of that. And of course, I mean, it's obvious some of the things that have occurred in the last couple of years. The NSS is really taking a strong role that we have some pretty strong opinions about where we should be going. Mm-hmm. And we are acting somewhat as a citizen's watchdog to make sure that some of these larger programs, which are very important in their own right, but we need to make sure that some of the smaller ones, which lead to what I call mission multipliers. You put a small amount of money in, but you get a huge benefit. Sure. The problem is sometimes when they're small, they're easy to sort of whittle away at the edges with cuts to feed into some of the larger things. And we're saying enough of that. That these programs need to be protected. They need to go forward. A couple of them specifically are the commercial, obviously the commercial cargo and the commercial crew program. Commercial cargo is starting to round out now. I mean, we're actually starting commercial services now, sure. At least with SpaceX and Orbital shortly behind. But commercial crew is the next thing that we need to fight for. There's also another line in the budget, the space technology line, and that's a new office that's been set up within NASA to do something sort of in lines of what the DoD does with DARPA, and that is take very high risk but yet high payoff things, buy down the risk, and then transfer that technology over to the operational side. And we're fighting every day to make sure that space technology line stays intact. So we are definitely not a rubber stamp. We're taking very aggressive stands on these things.
I think that's absolutely critical that we do that looking forward. And there's so much to talk about more here. Paul, we're going to talk a little bit more about NSS and how people can get involved here after we take our final break of the day. We'll come back, wrap up our discussions for the week, and we'll take a look at the local launch forecast. Again, you're listening to Space Talk on WMMB. I'm Jim Behnke. We'll be right back in just a few moments.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. This is Space Talk with Jim Behnke.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk. A quick reminder, you can stay in touch with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, just search for Space Talk. And if you're on Twitter, look for Space Talking. And always for one-stop shopping, just visit WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk. As we continue along with our program today, we do want to take a moment for our weekly look at the local launch forecast. We are just about 1 month away now from the next big launch from Cape Canaveral, Kennedy Space Center's Launch Services Program, and United Launch Alliance, still aiming to send an Atlas V rocket into Earth orbit on August 23rd with a NASA science mission on board. The Radiation Belt Storm Probes mission will be lofted into a highly elliptical egg-shaped orbit where it will study the effects of the sun on the Van Allen radiation belts that surround our planet. Launch time is a nice and early 4:08 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, so it should put on a good show for all of us in Central Florida. For more information about this and other various launches scheduled around the world, including the next launch from Kazakhstan of cargo to the International Space Station, do jump onto the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword space talk, and look for the link to our launch forecast. On the phone with us is Paul Damfus from the National Space Society, calling us from his office in Washington, D.C. And, Paul, we've been talking about everything going on here. I'm curious about about how tough the message is to sell right now. It seems like everyone thinks that our space program is dead. We have so much going on. You know, we've got active missions to the space station, launches happening all the time. NASA's getting ready to launch a little suborbital technology demonstrator out of Wallops, Virginia, hopefully tomorrow morning. Things are happening right and left, and yet we can't seem to convince folks of that fact. Are you finding it difficult to sell the message right now?
Yeah, it can be sometimes, and again, that really goes back to stepping out of the echo chamber and really getting this into the mainstream. But I mean, no more truer than in today's life. How do you get a piece of people's bandwidth? You know, people have so many different things coming at them that maybe some of the traditional space advocacy routes need to be rethought. One of our friends who writes the NASA Watch blog, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with,
yes,
he posted something after our conference, which said people listen to Tony Stark, not to space advocates, and Tony Stark being the main character in the Iron Man movie, who
right.
is loosely inspired by Elon Musk. And this was right after Elon and the SpaceX team had birthed at the International Space Station. And that's absolutely true. That's the stuff that captures people's attention. And again, our role as an education group is just that, is to educate folks on what it really means to have a space program and to invest time and money and resources and national treasure in something that we call a space program. We still have sort of the same elementary arguments from folks out there about, well, is that money better spent here, or is it better spent on this? And they, you know, kind of quotes in the air, space program. Well, the first thing is that all money that's spent on the space program is not spent in space. It's spent on Earth in the form of jobs and economic stimulus for the communities surrounding where these dollars are spent. But there's also it's hard to put a number on it, but there's a multiplier for the amount of money that we invest in space that comes back to us. So it really is a continuing process of educating folks. But as you said, the more robust things that we have going on, the easier it is to portray that message. You know, we have the Kepler spacecraft out there that's searching for Earth-like planets surrounding stars near, and there's constantly new data coming in from that.
Sure.
That's leading us to believe that Earth-like planets are not only out there, but they're ubiquitous throughout the cosmos. The New Horizons spacecraft is well on its way. I think well past halfway on its journey to explore Pluto. And when it does, that will round out our initial reconnaissance of our solar system. We'll have at least a very rough sketch of what our place in the universe looks like.
And it's all very exciting, but, you know, the problem that I've always had, and I'm sure you have it too, is that when you get the folks excited about it,
mm-hmm.
you can go to a baseball game and have Space Day at the stadium and have 30,000 people see an astronaut throw the pitch and get all excited about space. But how many of them are going to go contact their legislators? How many of them are going to go take that next step to be active and get involved and make the difference in Washington where it all has to happen?
That's right. And I will tell you that in the short time that I worked for Senator Nelson, it was an education for me on how these decisions get made. You know, being a Marine, I'm a very mission-oriented individual. I see a mission. You know, you plan a way to execute that mission, you execute it, you move on to the next thing. And that's not necessarily true in this city. There's a lot of different things that pull on that decision-making process. Our job is to really carry that torch and carry that vision for what is the right thing to be doing. But we also have to know that we operate in the real world, and we operate, especially now in a time of competing budgets and resource scarcity. But, you know, it's interesting. One of our directors just, about an hour ago, sent out a quote that he found from Robert Frost, which I'll just paraphrase. But the last thing is that it basically is saying that space is more popular than populous, meaning that folks in general support the space program. But until it becomes populous, until folks really have a stake and more people are there, more than the 500 or so that have already gone, it's going to be hard to get it into the mainstream. And that's where a lot of these space tourism things are very encouraging, because we're going to fly more people in the next several years than have ever flown into space. And that's when it's really going to come home
for
folks.
That interest is certainly a mile wide and inch deep sometimes.
That's
right. Paul, we got about 30 seconds to wrap up real quick. How can folks join the National Space Society? Give a plug for the website.
Yeah, the website's pretty easy. It's just nss.org. You go on there, and there's a button that you can click to join. It's only $20. You get a great magazine from it. You get access to a lot of our information. You get invites to particular events. You get information about your local chapter, and you become a voice. We listen to our members. We survey them, and we carry the torch for them. And really, as a 501c3 nonprofit, we really need strong membership to help us continue to push this thing forward.
That's
here,
right,
within the Beltway.
I'm a card-carrying member, and if I had to endorse one organization, it is the one organization to join. I've been a member for a long time and supported and written for the magazine, and it's a great organization. Paul, thanks so much for being on. We'll let you go. Get back to your Sunday afternoon, and be nice to those folks in Washington.
Thank you, and I give my best regards to the folks down on the Space Coast,
okay,
and thanks for your time, Jim.
Thanks a lot, Paul. We'll see you again. Hey, next Sunday on Space Talk, we're going to talk to Ashwin Vasavada, returning to the show for a while from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, talking about the Mars rover Curiosity. Should be a great show. That is it for now. Space Talk, a production of Mylas Solutions, brought to you thanks to the help of our sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. Thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station today. Please join us next Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for another live hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMNB presents a weekend edition of The Best of Bill Mick Live. I'm Jim Bankey. We'll talk to you again real soon.